Dirksen 226, which is right down the hall.
And Mr. Chairman, I understand also following our practice, the Republican Council and the Democratic Council normally work together on such issues. We'll brief the committee.
Senator Lay, that is correct.
Thank you.
We expect to return to hear our first outside witness, the American Bar Association, just as soon as we conclude this. We want to move ahead as promptly as we can, so those witnesses should be available. And we will now adjourn to 226 in this building.
And with that, the public inquiries, the questions to Judge John Roberts and his nomination to be Chief Justice of the United States have concluded. Judge Roberts now embracing his wife as he rises from the witness stand and shaking the hand of former Senator Fred Thompson, yes. And now leaving the hearing room here in the Hart Senate office building right next door, the Dirksen office building, where the Judiciary Committee has its offices and where this inquiry will go on. And Nina Totenberg, as I'm Neil Conan, by the way, NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, as Senator Specter was so careful to point out to a careful witness, this does not, we should not infer that there are any investigative questions of Judge Roberts that will arise from the FBI investigation.
And given the very short time they've allotted for this, I would suspect there aren't any. I want to clear up one thing. It just seems in the name of fairness one should do it. There have been a couple of times that Republican senators have mentioned positions taken by Justice Ginsburg when she was counsel for the ACLU, favoring the age of consent at 12 and embracing legalized prostitution. And I think I've checked those out. And I think those do not accurately reflect her positions. They may have reflected at some point the ACLU's positions, but not positions that she took in any way. And so I think that they're drawing a picture to make a point, but the facts are not entirely accurate. And so we probably ought to straighten them out.
Well, similarly, when Senator Kennedy was questioning the witness about a case, the courthouse steps case, he may have exaggerated the actual facts of the case.
Well, he actually didn't exaggerate the facts of the case, but he had the wrong plaintiff. There were a series of plaintiffs in this case against Tennessee because Tennessee had not comported with the Americans with Disabilities Act and had not made its courthouses accessible to the disabled. And one of the plaintiffs did, in fact, have to crawl up the steps of the courthouse in order to get to his hearing. But the person who's going to testify, Beverly Jones, is a court stenographer. And I think there were something like 26 courthouses in the state that were not accessible to her. And when she practiced in those courthouses, when she was carrying out her living, she had to be carried up the stairs in some cases by judges. And when I interviewed her, she said it was particularly embarrassing. At one point, one of the judges had to carry her into the ladies' room because her wheelchair wouldn't fit into the ladies' room and sit her on the toilet. So the senator got them mixed up. And there's another factual matter I want to clear up. We had a lot of discussion with Senator Kennedy today about this memo. Where is this memo so I can actually read it to you?
The redacted memo.
The redacted memo about the EEOC. And the Senator Kennedy spent a long time because he thought that John Roberts had suggested that the EEOC was somehow un-American. And Roberts said, no, I was responding to a complaint we had from somebody who said that the EEOC was un-American. And the senator said, no, I think you were saying that was probably true as well. So I'm going to read you what this memo says and then tell you why I think the senator probably is reading maybe more into it than one might imagine. So John Roberts, and this is dated June 7th, 1983, John Roberts writes, I have been unable to confirm that the president promised to abolish the EEOC, which is what the person corresponding said that the president had promised to do. We should ignore that assertion in any event, as well as the assertion that the EEOC is, quote, un-American, the truth of the matter notwithstanding. And so he does seem to be suggesting that the EEOC is un-American, but in fact, if you read a lot of these memos, what you see is that John Roberts has a sort of dry wit, and or you might say he's a snotty kid. I mean, depending on how you want to put it. But I don't really think that the tone of this letter suggests that the EEOC is un-American. What he's doing is making a joke. Not a very good joke, but a joke.
While we're awaiting the committee's return from the executive session and the beginning of the outside witnesses, let me bring Tom Goldstein into the conversation. He's our legal analyst here, and he's, of course, been an advocate before the Supreme Court as well, and talk about some of the issues that are involved here.
Terrific. I think that Nina points out a really good issue when it comes to John Roberts' relationship with the Democrats, because I think that John Roberts has largely satisfied the Democrats on a lot of their concerns. They are convinced that he is honest, that he is, as Senator Schumer said, a lawyer's lawyer. They do have concerns that they don't have enough information and that they haven't gotten complete answers from him. And I actually think that John Roberts is probably pretty close to getting a broad array of Democratic votes, and he could have gotten even closer by just acknowledging that some of the language in his memoranda for the Reagan administration was, he was a young kid, a kid, but a very young lawyer, and he had an a sort of a wicked pen. He certainly is a better writer than I am, in addition to a better advocate. And if he had just sort of stepped back, John Roberts has defended more than I think he needed to defend. But it is striking in the comments from Senator Schumer and Senator Feinstein how close John Roberts has gotten to assuaging their concerns. One really couldn't have imagined that a president who committed himself to appointing justices in the mold of very strong conservatives, ideological conservatives like Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, would come close to getting the votes of Senators Schumer and Feinstein. And we don't know what they will do ultimately. The only other comment that I would make is that I, with each passing hour, I become more impressed with this process, not less impressed. I think that both sides have been very fair. They really haven't engaged in character assassination, which some of the outside groups on both sides have tended to do in this process. I think the senators have been very sincerely interested in what John Roberts thinks and believes and what kind of justice he will ultimately be in Chief Justice. And so for Americans listening, I think they ought to be pretty pleased with how this has gone.
Let me ask some questions about some of the things that maybe, as Nina says, the burden here is on those who might oppose this. But John Roberts had to settle a few questions in people's minds and certainly the administration that nominated him. Qualifications?
That never was an issue. I mean, this is a superbly qualified person. And just because I get a lot of email about this from people who say, well, he doesn't have any Supreme Court experience on the court, and he's only been a judge for 2 years. Mm-hmm. He would become, if confirmed, the 17th Chief Justice. Only five of those were promoted from within the court. And in fact, most of those chief justiceships are not considered particularly successful. Chief Justice Rehnquist was the exception who proved the rule.
Let me ask another question, ethics questions. Now, there were questions raised about his interactions with the White House, that he was being interviewed for a potential opening on the court at the same time that in his capacity on the Washington, D.C., District Court, that he was hearing a case of vital importance to the administration.
That was the only moment yesterday when Russell Feingold was questioning Judge Roberts that I thought he looked at all defensive or seemed to be in a defensive crouch, and he conceded that he had been interviewed days before hearing arguments in this case, that he'd been interviewed by the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, that while the case was under consideration, he'd been interviewed by Karl Rove, by the Vice President, Dick Cheney, by the White House counsel. You know, when I interviewed Senator Specter just before these hearings, he said, I don't really think there is any question about Judge Roberts' integrity, but he might not have done this if he'd been looking, had a better rear vision mirror.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew he was under consideration for a Supreme Court justiceship at that time, although we didn't have a vacancy. He knew it was serious, and he had a case that was involved the administration. There's no question, if you know John Roberts' sort of philosophy of executive power, it's hard to believe he would have come to a different conclusion. But as in so many things, he doesn't really like to say, to admit any possible error. Even in his memos, when he's making sort of funny remarks, or one might, as some of his critics might say, or maybe he would admit, snotty remarks, he doesn't ever say, well, that was really a snotty remark and I wasn't being serious. He says, I didn't say that. I didn't really mean what you say I meant.
After the committee returns, we will be hearing from outside witnesses, beginning with a panel from the American Bar Association, and they're to be asked about their recommendation of Judge Roberts as highly qualified for the position of Chief Justice. After that, there will be outside witnesses, half invited by Democrats, half invited by Republicans. And joining us now is Charles Fried, a former Solicitor General of the United States. He served in that capacity during the Clinton administration.
Reagan
administration. Excuse me. I got my decade wrong. Excuse me there. And now is a professor of law at Harvard Law School in Cambridge. Good of you to be with us today.
Well, I'm very glad to be on your program anytime.
I wanted to ask you, have you been paying attention to Judge Roberts' testimony these past few days?
Oh, yes. Very close attention.
And how do you think he comported himself?
Just marvelous. Just marvelous.
One should say that Charles Fried, from the get-go, when there was a lot of talk about if there was a vacancy, who should fill the vacancy, Charles Fried always said the person who should fill that vacancy is John Roberts. But I wonder, Professor Fried, and we should also say that Professor Fried served for a period of time on the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court as a Supreme Court Justice. I wonder, if you, as you have listened to these hearings, if you sense a difference as the days have gone by, whether it seemed to me that at some point yesterday, Judge Roberts seemed to actually start to believe he might be the Chief Justice of the United States.
Yes, I think that's probably true. It seemed to be going well. His answers, though they didn't satisfy everybody, didn't cause a problem, and there were no surprises. There were no surprises, and when that happens, then you heave a sigh of relief.
That's from obviously looking at the process. How do you answer the Democrats' concerns about Judge Roberts? Not so much as a litigator, but concerns. I may have to summarize here. Basically, that he's a cold fish, an automaton, as they were saying.
Oh, that's completely wrong. But he is a very disciplined man. When I give my testimony, I'm going to read what he wrote in that famous French fry case. And it's clear that his heart went out to that little girl who was arrested for eating a French fry. And he said so. He said so, and the words were eloquent. There weren't tears on the page, but it's clear that he is not a cold fish. But he knew what his duty was, and he did it.
Now, this is the Washington Metro case.
That's correct.
Right. Go ahead, Nina.
I'm wondering what kind of a justice, Supreme Chief Justice, you think he will, what kind of a conservative you think he will be. You've known him for decades. You've worked with him. And I wonder...
That's wrong, Nina. I hardly know him at all. I may have spoken to him twice in my life.
Really? I thought you...
No.
All right.
What I know is his reputation and his work, and I've read all his opinions.
So do you think he will be a conservative like Felix Frankfurter, or a conservative like Antonin Scalia, or a conservative like Clarence Thomas?
I think he'll be a conservative like John Harlan, who was not a conservative like Felix Frankfurter, and they often disagreed. For instance, they got very crosswise on the subject of the Connecticut contraception law. I think he'll be more like Harlan, and I don't think he will be a conservative like Scalia, only because if you read his opinions, he doesn't say, when he's interpreting the Constitution, what we do. And I've read that in his opinions. He doesn't say that we look only at the intent of the framers. He says that's where we start, and he says usually. But he doesn't say that we stop there. He doesn't say in statutory interpretation, which is something Justice Scalia believes, that you just have the words of the statute. He says that's where we usually start, but we don't stop there. And in that respect, he is he has a much less rigid, much less mechanical view of the subject. I think actually Scalia also has a much less rigid and mechanical view than he himself will allow himself credit for.
You were talking about, you said that you thought John Roberts would be a chief in the, or a justice anyway, in the mold of Justice John Harlan, who you clerked for. And you talked about the way that Harlan and Frankfurter were different in the case from Connecticut, in which the court struck down the Connecticut law that made it a crime for married couples to use contraceptives. So explain what the difference between Frankfurter and Harlan was in that case, since you think it was a critical difference that reflects a little bit what your projection might be about Judge Roberts.
Well, Harlan was willing to see that there is a kind of momentum in constitutional provisions. And John Roberts said something very good in one of his answers. He said that it's not just the intent of the framers, but where they use general terms, then those general terms invoke principles, and those principles may very well, I'm putting words in his mouth, but I think it's roughly what he said, those principles may very well outrun the actual intent that the framers had.
Are you talking about the sense that then Griswold, in many people's minds, leads to Roe?
Well, I think Griswold quite clearly leads to Lawrence.
Let's say what Lawrence was.
Lawrence is the homosexual sodomy case. Mm-hmm.
Lawrence is the case where the Supreme Court struck down a Texas statute that made it a crime for consenting adults to have homosexual relationships in the privacy of their home. And the court said that violates those individuals' constitutional right of privacy, hearkening back to the Connecticut case, which established a right of privacy.
It's very hard to see how you can take the principle of that Connecticut case, and indeed the principle of Roe, and not reach that conclusion. On the other hand, the conclusion that you can't draw from that is the conclusion that my old court reached in the gay marriage case, where they said that a provision which, by the way, is identical to the federal provision in the Massachusetts Constitution, requires the state to celebrate same-sex marriages. I mean, that is a enormous jump beyond the direction in which the court's decisions had been going.
In fact, that was something of a debate in the Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court itself, when it invalidated that Texas sodomy statute, the majority said that this harkened back to a right of privacy, and all that you were doing was protecting people in the privacy of their homes, essentially doing what they wanted to do in their private sexual relationships. The dissent by Justice Scalia said, you are endorsing the idea of homosexual marriage. And the majority said, we're not doing anything of the sort. And that's where it stands today.
That's correct. And I would be surprised if Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, as I'm confident he will be by the end of the month, would join an opinion to overrule Lawrence. But I would be equally surprised if he would join, I would be even more surprised if he would join an opinion which took the same line as the Massachusetts Supreme Court took on gay marriage, because those are very different things.
So you don't see him necessarily as a as somebody with an agenda, as a revolutionary?
He has said he isn't, and I think he would much rather not be a judge and go on making $1 million a year than to lie to this committee about that or anything else.
You know, but when we look at who and what judges and human beings are, I don't know any judges who think they have an agenda. Do you?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
You think they actually think they have an agenda?
Yes.
Because I think most judges think that they're accurately interpreting the Constitution.
No.
Well, okay. We're gonna have to...
In fact, it is one of the things that some justices have said, and which their acolytes, their spokespersons in the academy and in the journals and so on and so forth, have said for them, and that it is the role of the court to have an agenda, to speak for certain interests, to make sure that certain things happen. If you read some of the speeches of Justice Brennan, he had an agenda. I think he told us he had an agenda.
Well, I knew Justice Brennan pretty well. I don't think he thought he had an agenda beyond what the Constitution called for. Now, you can disagree with his reading of the Constitution, but I think that he, just as much as Justice Thomas, for example, thought he was accurately interpreting the Constitution.
Well, but his notion of what it was to accurately interpret the Constitution was so unconfined. It was so capable of completely being coincident with whatever he happened to think was good and right, that is not much of an assurance.
Professor Fried, obviously Judge Roberts asked many times what kind of, would you be a justice in the mold of Scalia or Thomas or Rehnquist? He says, I will be my own man. But let me ask you, will he, he's at being nominated to replace William Rehnquist, who served as Chief Justice for a long time. We know a great deal about the way he thought and about the way he viewed the future of the court. Will he be a Chief Justice, if he's confirmed, in the mold of William Rehnquist?
He will be like Rehnquist in the way he presides over the court. Rehnquist was much loved by his fellow justices, including, may I say, Justice Brennan, because he was expeditious, he was fair-minded, and he didn't try to ram anything down anybody's throat. And I'm sure that Roberts will be that kind of presiding justice. But I think there's a difference between Roberts and Rehnquist. Roberts seems to care a great deal more about the precision of legal reasoning. Rehnquist was was willing to be somewhat looser on that subject.
There's an interesting question on that point, I think, from Senator Feingold this morning when he said, what about the practice of if you're the Chief Justice, would you switch your vote on a case in order so that you could then assign the opinion? This is an important
tactical. I heard that, yes.
And he said he would not.
And I admired that. Former Chief Justice Berger was notorious for doing just that, and it produced great incoherence. The most dramatic case was Fuller Love against Klutznick, which had to do with racial set-asides in government contracting, and he obviously took that side in order to control the opinion. And the result was so incoherent with so many opinions that nobody knew what the law was. Roberts would not do that.
In fact, there were many such cases because I along with Linda Greenhouse from the New York Times, had the exclusive advance look at the Blackmun papers. I spent about a month steeped in the Blackmun papers, which of course reflect the traffic of what's going on among the various justices and reflect also what goes on in the conference, because you see his notes. And there are cases where he writes in his, as he's recording the note, the various votes of the justices next to the chief's name, bet he changes his mind. And then 3 weeks later, you'll see a note, he's assigned the opinion, now he's changed. And there are lots and lots of cases, you know, one that you may not know about, but you, by now you probably do, was the legislative veto case, which is called Chadha, which had to be re-argued because the chief had assigned it to himself and then became sort of paralyzed because he didn't really seem to have reached a conclusion about what he was doing. And so when Rehnquist came in to have a chief justice who didn't monkey around, who said, okay, I'm not in the majority in this one, you guys assign the opinion, I am in the majority in this one, and then didn't play favorites. There are, in the Supreme Court, there are things, there are opinions known among the justices and their law clerks as dogs, because they're hard, they're not going to... they're
PACS
not,
cases.
They're not interesting. there's no ability to write with any flair, and God knows they don't get any press. And they don't even get much notice in the academic world. So they're called dogs. And Chief Justice Berger, apparently, when he got mad at a justice for not going along with him, would assign that justice a lot of dogs. And Chief Justice Rehnquist never did that.
Blackmun and Marshall became tax experts because Berger would give them the tax cases as punishment. That's quite right. Rehnquist didn't do that, and I cannot imagine Roberts doing that.
There are, of course, many other aspects of the job of Chief Justice, but I think most of the questions today focused on the questions of the temperament of a Justice Roberts, about what kind of... He said he would not bring his personal opinions, his religion, his value systems to his judgment. But the Democrats were trying to get an answer to, nobody ever can divorce themselves from the way they were raised, from what they learned as a child, from the things that they believe in. What do you truly believe in? And he kept going back to that question about the rule of law is what he believes in.
Well, I believe that. I believe he was being sincere. I don't know quite what else to say. He was questioned closely enough. Your listeners heard it. I can't add to that. If he was being asked, yes, but what unconscious forces will play on your opinions that you are not aware of, the answer is, of course, well, I'm not aware of them.
Of course, there are conscious ones.
Mm-hmm.
There are conscious ones because, you know, I'll tell you a story that... I see that the senators are at least coming back, so maybe we ought to let Professor Fried go, because God knows he may have to testify soon.
Well, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Charles Fried is a professor of law at Harvard and a former Solicitor General of the United States. He will be among the outside witnesses testifying today, and we thank him very much for his time today and for joining us here in this booth. I'm Neil Conan, along with NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. We're in the Hart Senate Office Building on Capitol Hill. Earlier, half an hour ago, the senators of the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee completed their questioning of Judge John Roberts. They then retired to an executive session to pose any questions they might have arising from an FBI investigation into his background to him in a private session. As Senator Arlen Specter, the chairman of the committee, explained beforehand, this should not be read as suggesting that there are questions that arise.
And it looks to me like there really weren't, because they weren't gone very long. They were gone about 10 minutes of that. I was about to tell you that I do subscribe somewhat to the what's called the what did the judge eat for breakfast theory, and that is that judges are influenced by their own life experiences. And I was about to tell you an example of that. The late Justice Lewis Powell once told me that about how he came to his views on abortion. And this goes back to when he was a young lawyer, and he got home one night, and there was his wife greeted him and said, "Your messenger at the office called, and wants you to come back for an emergency. And he went back to the office, and his messenger, who was about 19 years old, and was in tears. And it appears, as Justice Powell told the story, that the messenger was living with a woman. She'd become pregnant. She tried to abort herself with a coat hanger and was hemorrhaging. And so then Lawyer Powell went with his messenger to the place where this young couple lived, and they found this young woman there dead. And he turned his messenger in to the DA and persuaded the DA not to bring charges against him. When he was telling me this story, he said, ever after that, I was of the view that this was not the business of the government. It was a powerful experience he'd had, something that formed his views on abortion. And he knew it.
Senator Specter has returned to the chair. We're expecting next these outside witnesses. The first is representatives of the American Bar Association, which has rated Judge Roberts as highly qualified for the position of Chief Justice. Then five panels of witnesses, half invited Republicans and half invited by Democrats. And Senator Specter has vowed to conclude these hearings today. If he's to do so, of course, he's going to need to wrap up before the president's speech, which is scheduled to from New Orleans, scheduled at 9 p.m. Eastern time today. The Judiciary Committee is scheduled to vote on the nomination at this point next Thursday. If, as expected, Judge Roberts gets a majority, the nomination would then go to the Senate floor the week after that. And at this point, there's no reason to believe that he would not be confirmed. And if so, he would then be able to take his position as Chief Justice when the Supreme Court session begins, as always, on the first Monday in October.
You know, one of the things John Roberts is going to be doing this weekend is answering those written questions that the senators say they want. Of course, they'll probably be heavily edited by the White House and the Justice Department. But the other thing he's likely to be doing is starting to read briefs about Supreme Court cases that he's going to have to sit on the first Monday in October.
The first three witnesses we'll be hearing from are Stephen Tober, who's the chairman of the ABA's Standing Committee on the Federal Judiciary, Tom Hayward, the past chairman of that Standing Committee on the Federal Judiciary, the first one from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, the second one from Chicago, Illinois, and then Pamela Bresnahan, the D.C. Circuit Representative. She conducted the investigation of the ABA's evaluation of Judge Roberts. Let's go back to Senator Specter.
Went into executive session and reviewed the background investigations on Judge Roberts, which are routine, and Senator Leahy and I have been delegated to report that there are no disqualifying factors. We had Judge Roberts in for a very short discussion, and we returned to the hearing room to move ahead with our hearing. Senator Leahy?
I concur with that. The practice of this was begun with prior chairman. I think it's good to have it as a routine. We do this with Supreme Court nominees. We meet, go over the background. I agree with the chairman. There was nothing in the background of a disqualifying nature. And it was a pretty routine. And I mentioned this because I don't want anybody to read more into what is just, if anything, a housekeeping chore in this case.
Thank you very much, Senator Leahy. We have six panels of witnesses, total of 31 witnesses. It is our hope and expectation that we can conclude our work today. And while senators have rights to question, and we customarily have a five-minute rule, to the extent that we can move ahead promptly, it would be appreciated. And we start first with the American Bar Association and the chairman of the ABA Standing Committee on the Federal Judiciary is Mr. Steve Tober. Undergraduate in law degrees from Syracuse University Law Review, deeply involved in the New Hampshire and New England legal communities, former chairman of the committee to redraft New Hampshire's rules of professional conduct. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Tober, and thank you for your service. And now we look forward to your testimony. All witnesses will be limited to 5 minutes, which is standard under our rules.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Stephen L. Tober of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and it is indeed my privilege to chair the ABA Standing Committee on the Federal Judiciary. I am joined by Thomas Z. Hayward, Jr. of Chicago, sitting to my right, my immediate predecessor, and by Pamela Bresnahan, who was the 2004-2005 District Court, District of Columbia Circuit member, also of the 2004-2005 committee. For more than 50 years, the ABA Standing Committee has provided a unique and comprehensive examination of the professional qualifications of candidates for the federal bench. It is comprised of 15 distinguished lawyers who represent every judicial circuit in the United States and who individually volunteer hundreds of hours in public service to our profession. This committee conducts a thorough, nonpartisan, non-ideological peer review, and it does so by using long-established standards that measure the nominee's integrity, professional competence, and judicial temperament. In the sense that a major portion of the investigation consists of scores and scores of interviews with judges and lawyers, it is very much the voice of the bench and bar of this nation. Over the course of its history, the ABA committee has never proposed a candidate of its own, nor do we do so now. Its function, rather, is to receive the name of each nominee, investigate and evaluate the professional qualifications of each nominee, and then vote. While factors used in considering lower federal court nominations obtain here as well, the committee's investigation of a nominee for the United States Supreme Court is further based on the premise that such an individual must possess exceptional professional qualifications. The significance, range, and complexity of issues that such a nominee will face on that court demands no less. As a result, our approach to a Supreme Court nomination has two procedural differences. First, all circuit members of the committee conduct confidential interviews within their circuits. And second, the committee works with at least two reading groups composed of a team of academicians and a team of practitioners who analyze the nominee's writings in detail and report their findings to the full committee. After the comprehensive investigation is completed and assembled, each member of the standing committee reviews the report thoroughly and individually evaluates the nominee using three rating categories: well-qualified, qualified, and not qualified. Needless to say, to merit an evaluation of well-qualified, the nominee must possess legal ability, experience, and reputation of the highest standing. With respect to Judge Roberts' nominations to the Supreme Court, the Standing Committee has rated him twice. When he was first nominated by the President to be Associate Justice on July 29th, the 2004-2005 committee, chaired by Tom Hayward, undertook a complete evaluation and measured the nominee's integrity, professional competence, and judicial temperament. That evaluation included interviews with more than 300 judges, lawyers, and community members throughout the nation, a review of his decisions and selected substantive memoranda from the National Archives by both our reading groups and individual circuit members, and an in-person detailed interview with Judge Roberts. Based upon that evaluation, the 2004-2005 committee found that Judge Roberts was unanimously well qualified to be Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. When the President thereafter nominated Judge Roberts to be Chief Justice on September 6th, the 2005-2006 committee, which took office in mid-August with seven new members, performed a supplemental evaluation. That supplemental effort was focused solely upon the nominee's qualifications to perform the administrative and leadership skills incumbent upon the office of Chief Justice of the United States. This new committee had essentially a handful of days to perform that supplemental evaluation. Nonetheless, that supplemental effort included interviews with well over 80 judges, lawyers, and community members, a review of the materials gathered in the original report, and an in-person interview with Judge Roberts. Based upon that supplemental evaluation, and even with the change in membership, Judge Roberts was found by the 2005-2006 Standing Committee to be unanimously well qualified to perform the administrative and leadership responsibilities required of the Chief Justice of the United States. These two ratings, when considered together and in conjunction with the accompanying letter to your committee, which we ask to be made part of this record, provide the Senate Judiciary Committee with a comprehensive, independent peer review. Allow me to summarize. The ABA Standing Committee is fully satisfied that Judge Roberts meets the highest standards required for service as Chief Justice of the United States. He has the admiration and respect of his colleagues on and off the bench, and he is, as we have found, the very definition of collegial. Mr. Chairman, the goal of the ABA Standing Committee has always been and remains, in concert with the goal of your committee, to assure a qualified and independent judiciary for the American people. Thank you for the opportunity to appear here. We're more than happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tober, for your testimony. Thank you, Ms. Bresnahan, for your contribution. Mr. Hayward, for your contribution. We thank the ABA for your hard work and a very comprehensive report. Obviously, a great deal of effort has gone into it with a very extensive interviews which you have conducted. Senator Leahy?
They're probably going to feel left out and disappointed if we don't grill the three of them the way we grilled Judge Roberts for the last few days.
But I don't think so.
But on their behalf, I'm willing to waive that.
We'll take that risk, Senator.
A vote has just begun. I think we can move ahead into the next panel unless any of the members have any questions which are important to be asked, Senator Biden.
I just want to reiterate, we know how much work this entailed.
I mean, Joseph Biden, Democrat of Delaware.
Work, and truly, we thank you. There's been debates in this committee in the past about the relevance and importance of the ABA recommendation. I think it's important what you do. I think we all do now. And I want to thank you. It's a whole lot of work. And thank you, Steve, for your efforts.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hatch.
Let me just second that. I've certainly appreciated over the years the good
Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah.
And I have to say that over the last number of years, it's just been exemplary in every way. And I just want you all to know that, and we appreciate it. We know all the effort, and especially, Ms. Bresnahan, the effort that you've put in on a number of the judges that have come up in this area. You've worked your heart out, and I've got to say I want to compliment
thank
you.
Senator.
Senator Sessions?
Mr. Chairman, I would also like to thank
Jeff Sessions, Republican of Alabama.
Their work, and would just point out that in the course of making these evaluations, you talk to the judges, lawyers on both sides against whom they litigated. You know from your own personal experience normally who will give a fair and honest evaluation, how to evaluate and place good judgment on a person's professional skill. So I do think that provides a lot of advantages for our committee, and I salute that. Secondly, let me ask if one of you would comment, just as a professional lawyer who've been involved in the practice for many years, how do you feel about the tendency that sometimes occurs to judge a lawyer by their client rather than how they perform honorably and effectively in court? Would you share your thoughts about that subject?
I guess what I would say, Senator, is that
Stephen Tober,
a lawyer, is
ABA.
An advocate in the first instance and an officer of the court as well. And the roles are distinct, well-defined. And if we only defended those that didn't need our help, we wouldn't be doing very much for the American people. The role of a judge is very different. By definition, that person should know nothing about the case coming before them, should have no judgment about the parties in either way, and must be fair, fundamentally fair, at the end of the day, so that litigants and lawyers feel they've been treated properly in our system. The only thing, Senator, that keeps our buildings of justice standing is the respect of the American people, and that's the product that comes out of that building from judges.
And you would have some concern that if a judge judged lawyers by their clients and didn't give them the full fair hearing in court, I guess you would say.
That's true, Senator, and I adopt the comments of Steve Tober. And I would even add to that, you should not judge it by who the lawyer represents, because the lawyer, as you've heard over the last several days, is there as an advocate.
Thank you, Senator Sessions. Thank you very much.
I didn't want in my saying there would be no questions to suggest that we don't have appreciation. I have been chairman of this committee, as have several others here. And we do know the work. We do know a number of instances where you've gone back and followed up on things. It is not easy. I should note for the people that are watching this, you don't get paid for doing this.
That's right.
In fact, we couldn't have begun to afford it with the fees of some of you. If you did, you do this at pro bono. It is a tremendous service to the Senate, but it's also a tremendous service to the bar overall, and I thank you for it.
Thank you, Senator.
It is a high compliment to have no questions or few questions.
Yes. Could I ask one more?
we're diminishing the compliment now.
With regard to the lawyers and judges and others you interview, isn't it true that sometimes they're more willing to confide in you if they have a problem that they might share with someone else?
That was Senator Sessions.
Go ahead.
I believe that's true, Senator. Tom served 6 years before being chair. I served 3 as a member. Pam's been on for 3. We all have had experience in talking to judges, to lawyers, to other community members who feel very comfortable understanding that what they tell us remains in the strictest of confidence. And we are able to do a true peer review because of that. I thank the Senator for the opportunity to explain that. We do get information of the most important kind from the process that we engage in.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tober, Mr. President Hand, Mr. Hayward. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Chairman.
I think that report particularly valuable, Mr. Chairman.
I agree with you, Senator Sessions. We'll now call our second panel, Governor Thornburg, Congressman Lewis, Commissioner Braceras, Mr. Wade Henderson, Commissioner Kirsnow, and Judge Jones. While the panel is being seated, just a word of explanation. There is a vote in process, but there is a second vote behind that, so that when we break to vote, it is most efficient to vote a second time before returning. But we never know exactly when the first vote is going to end, so that our time is best economized if we arrive there about 20 minutes after the vote has started, so that we can return as promptly as possible. Our first witness is the distinguished former governor of Pennsylvania, Governor Dick Thornburg, elected in 1978 and reelected in 1982. Attorney General for both President Reagan and President George H.W. Bush, Under Secretary General for Administration and Management of the United Nations, currently counsel to the international law firm of Kirkpatrick Lockhart, and a longstanding friend of mine. Began in 1966 when I campaigned with him in Squirrel Hill when he ran for the Congress of the United States. Governor Thornburg,
we appreciate that.
Thank you, Chairman, for joining us.
Thank you, Chairman Specter, other distinguished members of the Judiciary Committee. It is my distinct honor and privilege to be here today in full support of Judge John G. Roberts' nomination to be the 17th Chief Justice of the United States. I've known Judge Roberts as a friend and colleague for over 15 years and can attest to his outstanding personal characteristics and undoubted integrity. Perhaps more important for present purposes, Judge Roberts' extraordinary legal skills and keen intellect are undisputed. Before his Senate confirmation by unanimous consent over 2 years ago to be a judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, he was heralded by leading Democrats and Republicans alike as one of the very best and most highly respected appellate lawyers in the nation, with a deserved reputation as a brilliant writer and oral advocate. He is also a wonderful professional colleague, both because of his enormous skills and because of his unquestioned integrity and fair-mindedness, that from his peers at the D.C. Bar. I can echo this fanfare because of the deep and lasting respect I have for Judge Roberts' legal abilities that I saw firsthand when he served as the principal deputy solicitor general while I was attorney general under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. In that capacity, Judge Roberts represented the United States government in all manner of cases before the Supreme Court, where he was charged to defend, among other things, legal attacks on the constitutionality of acts of Congress. John represented the government in 39 cases before the Supreme Court, while in the Solicitor General's office. He is a truly remarkable lawyer, bright, witty, capable, respectful, and creative. I had the good sense to enlist him as my coach for my final appearance before the Supreme Court myself in 1991, and we won the case. On the Court of Appeals for the last 2 years, Judge Roberts has demonstrated in practice the principles he has articulated as a young attorney working at the Department of Justice. Reflecting on the role of judicial restraint as a guiding standard for how courts should approach the judicial decision-making process, Judge Roberts explained in materials he drafted then for then-Attorney General William French Smith, and I quote, "The phrase judicial restraint may mean many things to many people, but at its core, it is a notion that federal courts must scrupulously avoid engaging in policymaking, which is committed under our system of government to the popularly elected and accountable branches of the states. Judicial activism," Judge Roberts stated, "is neither conservative nor liberal." He recognized that throughout history and to this day, both liberal and conservative interests have sought to enlist an activist judiciary in the achievement of goals which were not obtainable through normal political processes. Today, different groups urge judges to substitute their own policy choices for those of federal and state legislatures, but the evils of judicial activism remain the same, regardless of the political ends the activism seeks to serve. So said Judge Roberts. Indeed, he sagely recognized that the greatest threat to judicial independence occurs when the courts flout the basis of their independence by exceeding their constitutionally limited role and engage in policymaking. Let me highlight just one of Judge Roberts' D.C. Circuit opinions, which clearly reflects the correctness of his approach that cases should be decided upon the text of the statute, the Constitution, and the particular facts before the court. I know that most members of this committee are familiar with this case, which has been nicknamed the French Fry case. The facts are straightforward. The D.C. City Code made it illegal to eat or drink in a metro station, and the local transit authority imposed a zero-tolerance policy for violations, since it had received complaints about bad behavior in certain metro stations. A 12-year-old girl who stopped at a fast food restaurant on the way home from school made the mistake of eating a French fry while waiting for her friend to purchase a fare card. She was arrested and hauled off to jail for booking and ultimately some 3 hours later delivered to the custody of her parents. Was this bad policy? Yes. In fact, after the publicity surrounding the case, the city council adopted a new rule whereby they would merely issue citations to juvenile offenders rather than arresting them. Was the policy unconstitutional? Both the district court judge and the unanimous panel of the D.C. Circuit agreed that it was not, because age, or more specifically youth, is not a suspect classification under the Constitution or any act of Congress, and because probable cause existed to support the arrest.